This is Christopher Bandini, one of the co-hosts of New Books in Psychoanalysis, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Theodore Jacobs, who is a child and adolescent psychoanalyst, as well as an adult analyst in private practice. He is a clinical professor of psychiatry, emeritus at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and a training supervising analyst at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute and Institute for Psychoanalytic Education. Dr. Jacobs is also a past president of the Association for Child Psychoanalysis, and he's here today for us to speak about his book, The Possible Profession, The Analytic Process of Change. So welcome, Dr. Jacobs. One of the customary ways we start these interviews is to ask you, what led you to write this book?
I had been thinking about this issue, primarily that of the unconscious communication between animals and patients. For some time, it's been a kind of a strong, ongoing interest, and I wrote a series of papers with that major theme, although there are other issues I'm also concerned with, and I thought it'd be good, after quite a few years since my first book, to bring them all together in another volume.
It's quite a far-ranging book with and a lot of material is covered in it, and it really took me some time to read it because there's so much. It's a very rich book.
Thank you.
And of course, we can't really go too far without talking really about enactment and about your role and kind of how you've had that concept attributed to you. Can you speak a little about the history of that? And you also covered in the book, so I wonder what you can say about that.
Yes, as you well know, before the word enactment came into common use, we would speak almost always of acting out. The patient would act out, unless we go on vacation, the patient would act out, or the patient was angry, would take it out on someone else, and so on. And after a while, that concept, which was originally a neutral one, just to try to speak to the idea of action in place of thought, became used in a pejorative way. It was very rarely used other than in a kind of accusatory, the patient was doing something bad by acting out. And as a result, it seemed to me to have lost its original meaning. And I was simply searching for another word that would be better, at least more neutral, and perhaps convey something that would allow people to look at the phenomena rather than immediately take a prejudicial view of the patient. And the word English word enactment simply occurred to me. And so I used that word. I was not thinking of introducing any new concept or new idea into psychoanalysis. But it seemed to have hit a resonant chord because people soon picked it up. I guess everyone was looking for a word that would be better. And it now has taken root as a very common expression and one that has carried quite a bit of some different meaning than what I originally had in mind. I think the concept has expanded some.
Yes, can you speak a little bit about how it is different now? It does seem like it's kind of everywhere and it seems like it has different meanings. And I think you do address it also in the book. So any thoughts on that?
I'm sorry, did you see it everywhere?
It's kind of everywhere, and it seems to have different meanings everywhere. It seems to kind of, like you said, have gone off. And I think
originally, what I had in mind was that a patient would respond most usually to some experience of that was going on in the transference, not always well articulated, but was... There was a strong transference aspect to what I had in mind. The patient would have strong feelings one way or another and would put those feelings into action rather than filtering them through the concept of thought. But at the same time, I thought of enactment as almost always carrying a certain element of reenactment. That is, it was the repetition of some earlier way of dealing with a problem, which had may occurred in the person's childhood or adolescence, and and was sort of re-evoked in this current situation. I did not, in my original thought, limit it to simply the patient or the analyst, but it could be either, and either one could be enacting something, or it could be a kind of mutual process where the patient would respond to something he or she felt towards the analyst. The analyst might then enact something in relation to the patient. That was my original idea. Yeah, subsequently, it's taken on much more of the meaning of a mutual interaction between patient and analyst. So when people speak of enactment today, it almost always involves both patient and analyst, but still carries the original idea of an act in place of thought.
There seems to be also, of course, there's overlap with the concept of countertransference, and I guess your elaboration on countertransference not being simply something that needs to be analyzed away, and I think that seems to have something to do with enactment. Am I correct there?
Countertransference often takes the form of an enactment, even in very subtle ways. It ranges from, in my opinion, from simply something that goes on almost unobtrusively in an hour, such as the analyst turning from the patient, lowering a tone, speaking in a more stentorian tone at some time. These little bits of enactment are all part of the analyst's inner response put into action, which go on just all the time, aren't always picked up by either the person. But one can speak of them as kind of mini enactments, but they carry also in the countertransference of a larger, more obvious enactment, where an analyst is late for a session, or holds a patient over a long time, or finds himself perhaps changing the ground rules of the game by perhaps offering the patient extra time, but whatever it is, whatever goes on, it countertransference almost always carries some element of an action. It's not a pure countertransference feeling without having put it into action. It goes on, but it's relatively, I would say, rarer, because we all tend to express things with our bodies as well as with our minds. But transference enactments are equally common, as we all know who practice. Mm-hmm. So it's both transference and countertransference, I would think, that are often enacted.
In the book, you address many issues of technique. As I was reading it, I was thinking that it was at times, sometimes somewhat of an answer to some of the variations in technique that have kind of occurred over the, say, the past 20 or 30 years, especially around certain issues. I'll toss out a few of them and maybe we can address them in terms of, say, drive theory as one, or interpretation, or self-discovery.
What was the first one you said?
Drive theory. Like drive theory, yes. that many people who say they are analysts no longer say they're drive theorists. Many analysts no longer say that they believe in the primary action of therapy as being interpretation, and also the use of self-disclosure. So it was just a couple that I noticed as I was reading the book, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Well, Chris, my own feeling is that I don't think we should throw away the things that have been of great value for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I think of that as kind of the trunk of a tree, a very large, powerful trunk of a tree, which carries with it a great deal of wisdom, a great deal of knowledge accumulated over many years, to which we now add, branches, interesting new ideas and new ways of thinking, but never need to discard what has proven itself to be useful. At the same time, we don't want to just carry over concepts which have lost their usefulness. Drive theory is not as used as commonly today, but, I mean, I don't think we can completely discard the idea of human drives, because we all have them. They all are there. With some patients, they cause considerable anguish and conflict, and other people less so. I think our technique has moved away from the analyst as the silent listener and the observer and the fount of wisdom and knowledge who receives the patient's communications and offers some understanding through interpretation. That idea didn't take at all into account the constant flow and exchange of communication that goes on between patient and analyst, which carries so much meaning. So I think in the older days, when the analyst just offered interpretation, he missed a lot of the subtleties that were going on between the patient and the analyst. Interpretation still plays a very central role. But also what plays an important role is to recognize the verbal and nonverbal exchanges which communicate, you know, more than just what is said in words, but carry a lot of meaning. We've learned so much more about infancy, about nonverbal world, you know, existing until a child can speak. All of those have filtered into our techniques, so we put much more emphasis, I think, today on recognizing the dance, the nonverbal world, and the interaction between patient and analyst is a source of information.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right. Things have changed quite a bit, but it doesn't mean that human beings have changed, you know, fundamentally. We're still the human beings that we were fundamentally, you know, 50 years ago. The culture has changed, but not so much human nature. So I believe both in the old and the new, on the one-person psychology and the two-person psychology, I think both are relevant.
Hmm. Do you see is it kind of that in one-person and a two-person psychology, is there kind of a shift back and forth, say, between moment to moment in a session, or how do they both fit together, if they do?
I think they do fit together since the person... Our patient, for example, brings to us a backload of feelings and thoughts and conflicts and the history that they have, the years that we call those years of childhood calamity, where people have to deal with human conflicts around loss of love, or fear of bodily injury, fear of one's own superego, and all those things we struggle with, those are all internal. And they've been there in the patient long before the patient has met us. At the same time, there's the world of objects which the patient is continually reacting to from infancy on. And he learns, or she learns how to deal with the world of objects, develops strategies, ways of gaining gratification, of avoiding pain, and so on. Those get played out with the analyst as well as with others. So we're always dealing with the inner world as it expresses itself in the patient's life, and also in treatment, and the patient's way of dealing with the moment with the analyst. So one and two
mm-hmm.
seem to go together,
mm-hmm.
as they do in life, it seems to me.
Do you think that maybe classical analysts were doing it all along, but it wasn't mentioned, or do you think it's something that eventually got picked up? Or how do you think that developed, that the more classical stance started to kind of pick up on this idea of external relations or interpersonal relations kind of being important to the treatment?
Well, I mean, I think that one should try to recognize that even going back to the Freud's earliest writings, he was always interested in the world of objects. It's just that he put emphasis on the inner world of the patient, because that was what he was trying to establish first, the inner psychology. But he was well aware of the environment. He was well aware of the influence of parents, of caretakers, The fact he had some of his earliest ideas in Little Hans were about the relationship with the parents. And Dora, he had actually met Dora's father. He knew that he was a rather of a scoundrel, and he took that into account in how her relationship with her father influenced her and so on. But his emphasis as a sort of biological scientist at first was on the inner world. As people got more sophisticated and others began to write more about object relations, especially the English and British school, people began to expand their knowledge and their understanding. The relational school, which for a long time was sort of kept at bay and excluded from the classical tradition, began to filter in through our understanding of what the major contributors there had to offer. So I think it was a gradual expansion of knowledge, and I think, frankly, the dying out of the older generation that was both loyal to Freud but also closed-minded. Yeah. So it was an expansion of the field, I think.
I think you mentioned in your book about how when the analyst emigrated here, that they really felt they should keep a pure version of analysis, and that might have had an effect on kind of this more focus on the intrapsychic.
They were very protective of the professor. They were afraid that his great gift, which was, of course, a great gift, to the understanding of the human mind would be altered. Would be downgraded, would be sort of contaminated by American pragmatic culture. He did not particularly like America. He didn't like the general lack of depth and understanding of psychology. He didn't like the pragmatic approach of sort of living in this country. And so he was a little afraid of what would happen, and his followers were very protective of Freud. They became very suspicious of American psychology, even the American Psychoanalytic Association. They didn't particularly favor thinking of them as, again, taking away rather than adding to what Freud had to say. It took a long time for that to begin to wear away and for people to appreciate what others had to offer. You know. It's still sort of bifurcated on both sides, actually. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Relational school, was shunned a lot of the what Freud and Freud followers had to offer. I think largely because they were felt excluded from the analytic tradition that came with the Europeans.
Mm. Do you feel like
it was a difficult time?
Yeah. Do you feel like it's getting better? Is that bifurcation still going? I guess White has William Allison White Institute is now part of the international. So I wonder if that has if that's going to help or hinder things.
I think so. I think there's a gradual shift and change, greater acceptance from both sides. You know, it's a little bit uneasy because people have long memories, but basically, there's a definite movement, and I think a very good one.
And
we can learn from each other.
How can you reconcile maybe the Freudian stages of development with the new research in attachment and infant research?
Well, you know, I think that has been such a great addition because although Freud was a pretty good observer of human life and even of children, he did not have the research tools or the background to be able to do the fine observation that, for example, Beatrice Beebe and others are doing. So he didn't have the tools or really the knowledge to add as much as has been done recently about the early infant-mother relationship and how certain patterns are established very early. You know, by 4 months, by 6 months, there are certain patterns that are established, both internal regulation, ways of regulating oneself, one's feelings, and also dealing with the object and the mother or the mothering figure. and how those carry over to some extent. We never quite lose the earliest ways of being. Freud didn't, you know, he was one person in a different age. He couldn't understand that. But it didn't obviate the fact that what he did contribute about the way human beings develop and the stages of development, that still strikes me as being valid. So the job now is to integrate these things, which I think some people are really doing.
And the idea of self-disclosure and what people are, what analysts...
Self-disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Self-disclosure was, in my own training and experience, was pretty much a taboo. It was thought to be bad form, and it was sort of acting out on the part of the analyst. Because the analyst's job was to listen to the patient, focus in on the patient, and offer interpretations of the patient's inner world, not to disclose anything about the analyst. So when I began to write a little bit about this, I ran into a lot of opposition, a lot of condemnation, actually, being called all kinds of names for, exhibitionists, narcissists, and all kinds of things, because I believe that there was a place at times for offering something of what the analyst experiences, a way of helping the patient understand what they were projecting, you know, what they couldn't own themselves but were being projected, or through projective identification they were showing in such a way that the analyst would receive that information, but the patient was unaware of exactly what they were projecting, so that we could help a patient by sometimes sharing some of the inner experiences that we've had with them. This was not met with much favor, but little by little, again, as these worlds changed and the inner world of the analyst was seen to resonate with the inner world of the patient, and intersubjectivity began to be studied, then people began to say, well, now maybe, you know, the patient can learn something by our sharing some of our inner experiences, not our personal lives. That, I don't think, very rarely is that called for, once in a while perhaps, but mostly it's what we have experienced that is coming from the patient that we are able to offer them, you know. It's an additional tool.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be used selectively, because there, I think there's always a temptation to use the patient sometimes as a sounding board for the analyst and share feelings that are troubling the analyst, and have a kind of reversal where the patient becomes the analyst to the analyst. Or sometimes to issue an apology for something that one feels one may have done, or an excuse. I mean, one has to be a little bit careful, in other words, how much we, which way we use this.
Right. And do you feel like some of that care has maybe been discarded, at least temporarily, or have we swung too far in one direction?
I don't know, because, I don't see so much what other people have done. But in my own particular, little circle of people that I know, they all seem to be fairly careful about that use of it. It's not indiscriminate. Maybe elsewhere people don't have quite that discipline.
Yeah. And I guess another topic that's in the book that's really interesting is the future of the profession and where you see it going, and what's the future of psychoanalysis. I mean, you do mention how hard it is to get patients sometimes, or how hard it is to have a multiple frequency of patients. And I was wondering where you think it's going. It seems like in some ways the field is so vital in terms of conferences and books and research. But on the other hand, a lot of people are struggling with just those issues of how to keep an analytic practice.
Yes, I mean, certainly that is true. I myself, what I see is that a certain number of patients, not all patients, but certainly maybe a small number of patients, who are could use that in-depth approach, but are not receiving it because they either don't know about it or they've heard prejudicial things against it. And so they've been sort of partly fed by the media, by the general culture, that psychoanalysis is passé. It's all hacked. It's not a current, vital treatment. But as one gets more into a psychotherapy and realizes that the intensity, the frequency makes a difference, that one can reach areas of one's life and conflicts that on a more frequent basis begins to appreciate that, and the analyst can help them understand that, they can make a shift to some more, something deeper and perhaps more gratifying for them. So the analyst has to be more now of a bit of an educator and has to explain and has to be willing to meet some of the patient's needs, particularly in the area of fees. Many people are interested in, and would be interested in analysis, but they can't afford such high fees that some people are charging. And unless you have a practice of very, very wealthy people, part of having an analytic practice is being flexible in fees and willingness to meet some of the patient's needs. I think there'll always be those that are interested, but it's a small group, I think. What I see, for example, now in training is that there's a group of people, psychologists, social workers, others, some doctors, not as many physicians, who still have a keen interest in psychoanalysis, want to train, not as many as we used to have, but a small number. And if those people are flexible and know how to talk to patients about the value of analysis, all of them seem to have pretty decent practices. Those who hold out for high fees and aren't really invested in it and don't know how to talk to patients about it, they have more trouble, it seems to me. You have to be sort of committed to it and make sacrifices for it.
Right, in order to work for a lower fee in order to have somebody who will come at greater frequency and
and their willingness to meet some of their needs and time and schedule and so on. It used to be, when I first started, there were waiting lists for patients who wanted analysis, and we didn't have time for them. But that time has passed. But I don't think it's totally gone either.
Yeah, so many more options for treatment out there, and so where it used to be kind of the only game in town. Yeah.
Absolutely, sure. I mean, in the 40s and 50s, if you wanted in some psychotherapy, it was with an analyst and intensive work, usually. Now, one can get some very real and significant help through other means, cognitive therapy and other things that are, in fact, very helpful. But they don't deal with certain things because they're not geared to deal with character problems, long-standing character difficulties, relations with others that have been troublesome for years, certain chronic symptoms. I mean, you can't deal with some of these long-standing problems in a way that, is limited in terms of time and, like a 10 or 12 or 15 session treatment.
So we need to do a better job of publicizing the benefits of psychoanalytic treatment.
Very much so. We've been very poor in publicizing and letting people know what is valuable. Very poor. Other disciplines have done much better. Really. Use the media or the public press or television, in a way that we might be able to. We're not falsifying it, but simply presenting what is true.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the difficulties, too, is that there are so many theoretical orientations that it's hard to say which one responds to maybe that there's no necessarily proof or this or where the research is just starting to come out that certain techniques or certain theories may be more effective.
To clarify, there are certain things for which psychoanalysis is not suited. And, shorter term, more focused therapy is is valuable. I think most analysts do quite a bit of psychotherapy these days, and they do it usually quite well and effectively. The analytic training helps them in their psychotherapy.
In terms of training, I guess maybe just to ask you, who is an analyst? How does one be an analyst? In other words, I didn't go to a classical institute. I saw patients three times a week, and I understand that some institutes are because of the dearth of patients are allowing people to train at twice a week. You know, and of course the old issue of the couch and versus not the couch and this type of thing. Is everyone who trains?
Well, you know, I mean, there's a formal sort of analytic training through an institute, and that certainly is still, you know, a very good way to develop one's analytic skills. But people, you know, analysis doesn't depend on entirely on the frequency. It's not defined by four times a week or five times a week. It's defined more by, you know, one's approach to the mind, to the way of working. Some patients can have a rather deep analytic experience on much less frequency. You know, I mean, three times a week for some patients is all they can manage, and it can be very good and very helpful. And it's not that they're not in analysis because they're coming three times a week, or sometimes even twice a week. it's more the attitude of the analyst and the way he works with the patient.
So that's quite a shift over time. I think that's it's much more flexible.
Yes, much more flexible than it used to be. You know, it used to be an analyst defined by, you know, certain external criteria. You know, it wasn't analysis if it wasn't four or five times a week. Well, that's not really the way it is. In fact, as you know, in the international psychoanalytic, there's some societies and institutes in which three times is standard, both for the candidates and the patients, like the Paris, the French Society, for example.
So in your view, you're saying we're kind of moving past some of these old, boundaries, old lines that were drawn.
I think so, yeah. Mm. And we're looking more at what the work actually is rather than the externals.
Any thoughts about the role of neuroscience and some of the new MRI research that's going on and maybe its application to psychoanalysis?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated, as many people are, by the some of the research and the findings about the brain, the fact that they seem to have verified some of Freud's earlier ideas about drives and where things are registered in the brain. It's all very fascinating, but I have not yet quite seen how that interesting research has been effectively applied to the clinical. I think it will be. And I know that people like Mark Solms, for example, have been speaking about the clinical use of the newer neuroscience research. But I don't think it's quite taken hold yet. Maybe we're just not there yet. You know, one thing that does seem to be true, though, pretty well established by now, is that the talking therapies do affect the brain. You know, they do affect, you know, the way, for example, drives are processed, the way conflicts are dealt with, so that there seems to be a real effect on the neurophysiology of talking therapy, and that's very interesting in itself. You know, we used to think it was only medication or drugs that would do that. So that's interesting. And I think more will develop. You know, we're really in the infancy of this the whole field, you know.
Yes, I think so. It's kind of something about the repetition of talking with the same person every week that seems to have an effect on the neurons and kind of, and on people's well-being.
Yeah, it seems to affect, you know, the fixed pathways begin to be altered. And apparently, and the research on mirror neurons is also very fascinating, you know, because obviously in some way, you know, we take on from our treatment, our analysts or our therapists, we take on their way of being, some of their motor behaviors, you know, identifications, new identifications take place. and partially perhaps through the whole mirror neuron network. You know, I'm not a neuroscientist, so I can't speak with sophistication about it, but I'm very fascinated about how this is coming in to our field. We haven't yet been able to use it every day in our work.
Towards the end of the book, you speak about your love affair with theory, and with you mentioned a few theorists. Hans Lowald comes to mind, and also your relationship with Charles Brenner. So I wonder if you had anything you could say about that.
Yes. I mean, first about theory, I think we all have to have some theory, some way of working. Otherwise, we'd be kind of lost. That theory acts like a guide for us, a way of orienting us towards the patient, whatever our theory happens to be. But we don't want to be slaves to it either, because, you know, patients don't read the same books as we do, and they have their own way of thinking and expressing themselves. So we have to be open to always receive what the patient tells us in as open a way as possible, and not just be looking, you know, to verify our theories. So with theory, one has a little bit of an uneasy relationship. I mean, we both need it and value it, and also need to sort of separate from it and to listen freshly to the patient. And maybe the patient is telling us something that doesn't fit our theory. Well, we have to then listen to the patient, and perhaps from what he tells us, we will find a new way of approaching him, a new theory that fits. I was very taken with the work of Lowald, who in the 50s and 60s was seen by the classical school as someone who wasn't a really true Freudian. Although he was trained in Europe and Berlin, I think, or someplace in Germany, and he was a scholar, a great scholar, and a philosopher as well as an analyst. And he was as well trained in classical analysis as anyone could be. But he also had experience with the relational school and appreciated much of what they had to say about how the environment impacts us as children and how we're always responding to the environment, as well as the inner world. But when he veered away and spoke of the importance of the analyst as a new object, which he certainly, we are, you know, we're both old in the sense that patients see us in light of prior objects, but new in the sense that we offer something new and different. When he spoke about the new object, the old school tended to dismiss him as being less than a true Freudian, and he didn't get his due as one of the most creative and in-depth thinkers of his time. In fact, his work stands today, I think, almost like no one else's, as enduring. I always ask students to read a lot of Lowell because I think it's invaluable. Charlie Brenner was an old friend, a mentor for many, many years. I was in study groups with him for many, many years. And I came to appreciate his straightforward thinking and writing, his valuable way of looking at the psychology of our patients, his emphasis on data coming from the analytic situation, not from speculation, not from theory that couldn't be substantiated, but listening to the patient and getting whatever theory one develops from the data of the hour. He was very good that way, but he was also a man of his time, and he had very fixed ideas, which he didn't alter easily. He had sort of a set way of thinking, which was valuable, but not inclusive. For example, he didn't put a lot of emphasis on the pre-adipal years. He said, well, they may be important, but that data doesn't come through, you know, directly in the analytic situation. And I think he said that because he wasn't watching the movements of the patient, the whole nonverbal expression of the patient. He was focusing on the verbalizations, which are more sophisticated after all. You know, they come from a time when a child can speak. So I think he missed a lot, but he also added a great deal by his recognizing certain ongoing themes that occur in almost all our patients. I spoke before, a few minutes ago, about the calamities of childhood. That was his idea, that some of those early experiences, you know, and the solutions that we have to them as children remain with us and become part of our inner world. And we bring them to every new relationship. So if one understands those earlier solutions that a child comes to, you know, as it's trying to resolve Oedipal and other issues, then we have a better understanding of how they're approaching their conflicts today. Many things of value that he offered. And he was also open-minded. He said, well, you know, the tripartite system, the ego, the superego, and the id, that's a way of thinking, but it doesn't really exist in patients. They don't have a division like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to think of it that way for our own understanding. But his approach to the mind was closer to what actually the neurophysiologists are saying today. A flux of drives that keep shifting and changing and impulses that are, you know, moving in all directions. And what we have at the end is what he called the compromise formation, the final pathway, the neurophysiologist might say, you know. So he thought of himself as a neurologist his whole life. He was, in fact, a neurologist. In his early years.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was. He came to Montefiore as chief of the neurology clinic, and he worked with some of the great neurologists of his time, and he never lost that perspective, really.
So we're coming up to the end of our 50-minute hour, so I just wanted to ask you if there's anything I haven't covered, something that you'd like to say before we finish.
No, just that I thank you, and I think that I do maintain a certain optimism from what I see of the young people coming into the field. Some of the brightest and best people I've seen in years are now studying and learning and offering new perspectives, so I have a lot of hope for the future. But we have to be flexible. We have to try to meet patients' needs more and not, you know, simply hold on to concepts that no longer are useful and be what we ask our patients to be, to keep learning.
Yeah.
So, thank you so much for this time and your time.
Yes, thank you, and quite a nice way to end it optimistically there. And we've been talking to Dr. Ted Jacobs, and this has been Christopher Bandini for New Books in Psychoanalysis.